national statistics. According to a 2015 City Lab magazine report, one-third of Americans never interact with their neighbors at all. They vaguely recognize them, but they don't know their names or anything about them. And many of us aren't quite certain how we should even take our neighbors. In a research survey conducted just earlier this year, Pew Research Council stated that 48% of Americans feel like they can only rarely, if at all, trust their neighbors. We look at them with not just unknowing eyes, but with questionable eyes. What are your motives here? And some of us blame that shift on world events that have made us more fearful. Others claim that social media has made neighboring unimportant or irrelevant since we now have friends scattered all throughout the world. Many even chalk it up just to increased television watching that helps keep us isolated from one another. Sociologists argue we just have limited social capital, the time and attention that we are willing and able to dedicate to things. And so we choose to spend it on things that we hold more dear, Facebook and FaceTime over face-to-face interactions, and social networks and Netflix over our neighbors. It often isn't intentional, although if we're honest, sometimes it can be. We like to drive in that garage and not see anybody sometimes. But it leads to a loss of community. And even when we are in community, we prefer to be with people who are more like us. The same socioeconomic status, the same education level, similar interests and hobbies. We want our community to feel comfortable, which for many of us means just like us. And that was Israel's problem in the first century also. You see, they knew the Torah very well, those first five books of the Old Testament. And when they heard Leviticus 19:18, they emphasized something else and took it by heart. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself, for I am the Lord. And what they heard when they read this verse and heard this verse was, neighbors are only from our people. They're fellow Israelites, people who are just like us. And then they say, well, it's just reiterated by these following verses that talk about not mixing fabrics or animals or crops. And that just cements in their mind, like things need to stay together. We're meant to stay separated and segregated from the tribes around us, they thought. Those aren't our neighbors. Those are our enemies, because they're not at all like us. Now, it does mean they have to overlook the place where God says just a few verses later, this, when a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat you. Do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated like your native born. Love them as yourself. But you see, that doesn't fit the narrative. Because in their minds, Israel is God's holy and chosen people. Yahweh himself said, you are my treasured possession. And others from outside, you're welcome to join us in worshiping. But anyone who doesn't come to be part of Israel in full participation in the covenant and in the Torah, not just in observing all the things God says in the law, but also in things like offering all of the sacrifices and undergoing circumcision. If you're not willing to do that, then you're second class at best. And all of that is what lies behind the lawyer's question in Luke chapter 10. On one occasion, we're told an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What's in the law? Jesus replied. How do you read it? And he answered, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your strength, and with all of your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You've answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this, and you will live. And the expert's opinion is exactly what Jesus had already reiterated in Mark 12 and Matthew 22. And some people see this as the same story that we find here in Luke, while others say it's different because Jesus isn't responding. It's this lawyer who's answering in the way. But the message is the same in either case. The greatest command is not one, but two. Love God and love others. And Matthew, as he tells this story, adds a phrase in Jesus' telling. The second is like the first. They aren't two separate commandments at all. Loving our neighbors is like loving God, and all of the law and prophets hang on these things. And this interaction between Jesus and the expert in the law drives this home. loving God and loving our neighbors are intertwined. One cannot claim to love God without also allowing that love to motivate their actions towards other people. And if you do these things, Jesus says, you will live. You'll enjoy long life and blessings from God, just as the Old Testament had promised. And to the lawyer, that's all well and good, but he really wants to draw a line in the sand. And who is my neighbor, he asks. His question is one of selectivity. He wants to know exactly who he has to consider a neighbor and who doesn't count. He wants to justify his actions. But rather than answer his question, Jesus tells him a story about four men. A man has been in Jerusalem probably to worship, and he's headed back home via the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. And on his way, he's waylaid by robbers who beat him, steal everything he has, and leave him for dead along the side of the road. And two men come along, Jesus says, but they just pass him by. But a third man sees the victim, has compassion on him, and picks him up. He cleans him off, he gives him medicine, he bandages his wounds, and he takes him to an inn. And not only does he do all that, but he opens up a tab and says, if this doesn't cover it, I'll be back through later, and I'll pick up anything and any extra expense you might have incurred. And if we've grown up in church, we know this story quite well, don't we? I mean, many of us have even colored pictures about this story along the way. And because of that, for many of us, the story has lost its shock value. But for Jesus' audience, and especially for this expert in the law, Jesus defies societal expectations, and their world turns upside down. Because he shows two of their heroes in a very unfavorable light. The two men who pass by are not just normal, everyday people, but they are a priest and a Levite. They're the religious workers who worked in the temple. The priest led the people in worship. He would intercede with God on the people's behalf. He performed the sacrifices and the offerings that would help people stay right before the Lord. And the Levite made sure that everything kept working. They kept the temple in good repair. They cleaned and polished and prepared and labored, all for the glory of God. It's like Mark and me walking along in this story. And yet both of us see that man's need and pass on by. And we don't know their motivation. It could be that they think that this is a trap, that this man laying there is simply a decoy and the robbers are waiting nearby. It could be that they want to remain ritually pure because touching a dead body would make one polluted. Now, according to oral tradition, priests could take care of a dead body if there was no family to do so, and they wouldn't remain defiled. But let's be honest, who really wants to take that chance? And Jesus tells us here that he uses the same verb to go down as he uses for the man and for the priest. They're not headed up to worship. They're headed home. And at least for the priest, he probably has something better to do in his mind, some other place he would rather be. It could be they pass by just out of a desire to remain isolated from the incident. This isn't my problem, and I don't want to get involved. What happened to this man is terrible, but thankfully it didn't happen to me, and I'm not certain I can do anything for him. But if I stick around here, the same thing might just happen. Whatever their motivation, they pass on by, going to the far side of the road to distance themselves from the problem. Here are the heroes of their society, men of God who are seen as righteous and upstanding, and Jesus describes them at best as apathetic and uncaring about the plight of their victim. But then Jesus blows their mind. But a Samaritan. And for us, we don't get the venom behind that phrase. In English, because of this story, a Samaritan is now understood as simply someone who does what is right and what is good. We have good Samaritan laws in our culture, and relief organizations called things like Samaritan's Purse. A Samaritan's a good guy. But in Jesus' day, Samaritans were social pariahs and cultural outcasts. Samaritans were seen as half-breeds, and I apologize for that term, but racially and religiously, They were descendants of the remnants of the tribes of Israel when the northern kingdoms were conquered by Assyria. The Assyrians took everybody they thought had worth and left only the worst of the worst behind. And then they moved all sorts of other people in. And because you just need to be with your neighbors, they began to intermarry. And they even converted them to believing in Yahweh. But Samaritans saw themselves as the true Israel, and Israel saw them as impure. So Samaritans built their own temple. They rearranged the Torah, and they disregarded all of the prophets because none of that's important if we are the true Israel. And Jews hated them for it. And so they tried to avoid walking through Samaria as much as possible. They crossed to the other side of the river to get away from them. They wouldn't even associate with Samaritans religiously, socially, and if they could even help it, economically. Samaritans were considered worse than Gentiles, worse than the Roman overlords who ruled over them in Jerusalem. But their adversary becomes the hero of the story. And for the people of Israel, and especially for the experts in the law, the only one who counted as a neighbor was a fellow Israelite. Anyone else is other. But Jesus' question cuts through their debate to the heart of the matter. And he asked the man, "Which of these do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robber?" Before this, you would have said the priest or the Levite were more important. Not only are they fellow Israelites, but they're religious and really religious at that. They're the elite of the elite, the cream of the crop. But this expert is forced to admit that the true neighbor was the one who did good and who had mercy on him, the victim. He's forced to come to grips with the fact that it's not just your fellow Israelites, those from among your people. Your neighbor might just be the foreigners who are walking through and living in your lands, or those who aren't quite like us in our background, in our beliefs, in our nationality, or our political ties, those with whom we think we have absolutely nothing in common. So who are the Samaritans in our culture? And that question and that answer might be different for each one of us. And we really have to be careful making these parallels because there aren't a lot of direct parallels in our society. Samaritans were on the outside religiously because of their ethnicity and because of the experiences of those that were listening to this story. Samaritans were seen as completely unlike anything that you would want to be like. So who are the Samaritans? Well, maybe in our minds after this week, it's Republicans or Democrats. Maybe we find the view of the other even more explicable than before and even more solidified as inherently bad in our own minds. Maybe that's your Samaritan. Or maybe it's a Syrian refugee wearing a hijab and carrying a prayer mat. And we're not certain we can trust them because of their background and their beliefs. Or maybe it's an illegal immigrant who's not carrying a green card, who came to the U.S. simply to be able to take care of their family, or to escape the violence in her home country. Or maybe it's members of a different political or social movement that you disagree with, whatever that is, from Black Lives Matter to Blue Lives Matter to Greenpeace to members of the LGBTQ community, those that might feel at odds with everything that you think or believe, or fill in the blank for yourself. People who are not like us, or people that we might not like. But here is the challenge. Jesus tells us not just to love people who are like us. In fact, Jesus tells us over and over and over again to love our enemies, to pray for them, and to do good to them. Jesus' words to the expert in the law are the same that we need to hear in our society today. Go and do likewise. Go and love your neighbor. Show love to others because of the love that you have for God. Show mercy and compassion even when it seems difficult. Display love and kindness, whether it's giving a hug or sharing a meal or drinking a cup of coffee together or simply sharing in a conversation. Because too often we erect barriers between us and other people not like us. Instead, God says, make a gate. Be a neighbor. And yes, I know what I'm asking us to do is difficult. And it feels impossible and impractical. And trust me, I know that it's inherently uncomfortable. And at times it might not even feel like it's safe to do. But it is what Jesus is calling us to do. And then Jesus doesn't just say it, he does it. He models it for us. Jesus touches lepers. And he eats with sinners and with Pharisees. And he hugs outcasts. And he enters into deep discussions about life and theology with Samaritan women who are so ostracized that they don't hang out with anybody else in their own community. And he calls us then to serve in his name, to invite people to dinner who can't repay us, to show compassion to all people, to extend mercy to anyone who has need, to take the good news then to those who need to hear it, to proclaim freedom to those who are enslaved or imprisoned, to bring physical or emotional or spiritual hope and help and health to those who need to hear it the most. Jesus calls us to be a good neighbor. We're called to love God with all of our heart, our soul, our mind, and our strength through our words and through our actions. Our lives are meant to be a reflection of that love we have for God, and so we love other people. We love our neighbors as ourselves. And so we go and we do likewise. And for many of us, it's inherently uncomfortable to start with the people that we mentioned before. So I want to challenge you then to start at home. Start with your neighbors, those that you live near and spend time around or see often. As Christians, we're called to be good neighbors, and we need to actually know our neighbors to be able to do that. We need to be the first ones who break those statistics about America. We need to be people who know our neighbors so that we can love them. So get to know those who live around you. Learn their names and what they do. Learn what they enjoy. Learn the areas in which they might need help. And learn the things that they're good at so that if you need it, they could come and help you too. Serve them as you can and let them serve you as they can. Pray for them and about them and look for ways to share God's love with them. Get to know your neighbors and love them and serve them like you would those who are like you. And allow them to serve you too. It isn't just about us being servants for others. It's also about allowing others to serve us. And that's incredibly difficult for me to say because I like to serve and not to be served. But it's about accepting help. It's about going for the meal if they invite. It's about sitting down together or talking in the yard. Being a good neighbor is as much about graciously receiving as it is about serving and extending grace. I read something incredibly challenging this week, something I keep coming back to and wrestling with. One of the theologians I read made this statement about this text. Can you recognize the hated Samaritan as your neighbor? If you can't, you might just be left for dead. And so we shouldn't discriminate against others. We are commissioned and challenged to extend God's love and grace to the whole world. We can't just go to the other side of the road when it seems uncomfortable or when people are unlike us. Instead, Jesus says, go and do likewise. Our love for God is displayed in our love for other people. And everything else that we say and do and claim and believe is founded on those two commandments. And what's amazing is we have a God who models that for us. In the presence of Jesus, Jesus leaves the glories and comforts of heaven behind to become like us, to live and to dwell among us, to share hope and life and healing from God, and to tell us there's something more than what we often live in. Jesus became that good neighbor for us, giving us love and grace. And he wants anyone who needs it to accept it from him. And so that is the message for you today. If you need the love and grace of Jesus, we'd love to help introduce you to him. And all of us need to go out and extend love and grace from God to other people. May we be blessed and God be glorified through the things that we do this week.